Hey everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome back to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. This one presented by Manscaped. That's a new thing, right? But hey, we're here doing another true crime boxing history episode of Knuckles and Gloves. That means I'm here with my man, Arispina, my bro from Cauliflower Row. I just made that up. It's not too bad, right? How's it going, man?
Man, perfect rapper. Everything is good, my dude. You know, like you said, this is another episode they're about to do on a very interesting subject. Our man Trevor Burbick over here. And we get to talk about 80s heavyweights, which is my wheelhouse. You know what I mean? Like, I love that lovable, crazy bunch from back then. So this is going to be really interesting, man. A lot of people, Trevor Burbick is normally just known as a footnote and kind of like a... almost like a laughing gif at this point from the way he was knocked senseless by Mike Tyson and losing the WBC title in 1986. But there is a lot, and I mean a lot more to his story than just being the first guy that Tyson demolished for a title. And we're here to explain it to you. Because trust me when I say this is a crazy, wild story from beginning to end.
Yeah, man, it's a pretty gnarly story. Obviously, we're here talking about it because it's a true crime story, but... some people might know the end of it. And I guess that's kind of the challenge of doing these true crime episodes is that often people already know how these things end. And so that's the challenge is kind of like, sorry to book drop again, but just like with my book, the challenge was, you know, the end, but you need to be able to kind of construct a way there that makes sense. And that's, I guess, entertaining.
That's exactly. That's always the way though, is that you just know the footnotes. I know the ending. I know what happened with this. I know what happened with that. Do you really know the meat between the bread? You know, it's like there's a lot of layers and a lot of stories of how we got to this way and what happened and all that. So,
yeah, and with Trevor Burbick, there are a lot of layers and a lot of things that happened.
And a lot of it too is because a guy like Burbick was a person that he just told a lot of stories. You know, every one of his stories from his childhood up till from his fighting, how he began fighting to how his career started, reasons why he lost fights, everything had a story to it. You didn't really know. There was like layers of truth at the same time. He might have been adding something like no one really knew anything all the way to his birth. You don't really know with Burbick. There's always so much little bit right. Mystery for them because he always gave a different story for something. There was never, you can never just like completely, pinpoint something all the way back to what it needed to be because he would always add another layer of something different to it that would kind of like, he would tell one person one story, tell another person that same story, and then go to three other people and tell them that same story, but then like twist it up a little bit different, already adding new details that weren't in the original. And then everyone has a different version of, you know, where they come from with it.
I think that's another challenge with this one in particular is that a bunch of this information is coming from Trevor Burbick himself, and you really have no idea how reliable he is at all. And because like you said, he was always changing his stories, and the stories that he was changing were like outlandish. He'd go from something outlandish to even something even more outlandish. That's the difficulty here. But well, I guess just getting right in
with that era then, doesn't he?
He does. And like you opened up saying, the 80s and 90s heavyweights are like your favorite. So this is the perfect show for you to shine. And I'm definitely going to make sure that I hand over the mic for you to shine at key moments here, buddy. But I did do some research. I did do a little bit of, right. We do spend a fair amount of time and effort doing this stuff. So I'll just get right to it and say, just to set the stage here, when Trevor Burbick was 16 years old, like you said, we don't even know for sure if he was 16 because the date of his birth is kind of up for dispute. But when he was 16 years old, he claimed he saw a vision of God that steered him toward Christianity, that pointed him in the direction of being a Christian or something like that, which would be something of a theme throughout his life, despite the trouble that he would get into, that he would kind of lean on his faith for whatever that was worth. And frankly, it wasn't really worth a lot. But in any case, according to Burbick, and again, taken with a grain of salt, if not an entire, you know, dump truck of salt here, he got into boxing, he said, because he served as a maitre d' at an officer's enlisted club in the at a U.S. Marine base in Guantanamo, Cuba. So he said an officer picked a fight with him, and he kicked the officer's ass. I don't even know how believable that is.
Said he took up some karate, and he used that when a guy tried to jump him. Yep, around like the officer and did that.
It kind of, I mean, maybe it's because I come from, you know, a military family that, like, you know, or I don't know, maybe I'm talking totally out of my ass here, but it seems like if you're at a military base and you attack an officer, you're probably like not going to be offered boxing lessons or some shit like that. But I could be wrong.
Again, they said you should join the team after he beat him up.
I could be wrong. But he said that he was given an opportunity to get American citizenship, but he said he avoided it because the Vietnam War was still ongoing and he did not want to be drafted in the Vietnam War. So
also too, another story that he claimed how he got into boxing. See how he said there's different stories and different layers to this. He said that he was always breaking up fights on the ship and always trying to be the peace mediator. And because things would get so rowdy, he figured he had to learn how to fight himself to become, you know, so he wouldn't get himself hurt when he was mediating fights over there.
So already we got a fork in the road.
Exactly. But regardless, he ended up realizing that he was a pretty talented fighter, and soon enough he ended up in Canada.
That's kind of, I guess, where the real boxing story starts. And, you know, we can get away from the rumors a little bit, at least for a moment. So he claimed to have only 11 amateur fights when he started fighting. He represented Jamaica in the 1976 Olympics in Montreal, and he was trained by a guy named Tom McCluskey. And Tom McCluskey later said of him that he had a split personality, quote unquote. He wouldn't really go into much detail, and especially because this is something that he said after Burbick's death. So it was probably somewhat sensitive and raw and whatnot. But he didn't elaborate much. All he said was that there were a lot of times when Burbick was really happy. He was in training. He was doing great. But then there were other times when he was sullen and he just wouldn't talk to anybody. So already, you know, we're setting the stage, or we're laying the groundwork for a pretty interesting guy, if not somebody who's got a bit of a dark side, even though it hasn't really presented itself yet, you know?
Absolutely. He, like you mentioned, he represented Jamaica. Didn't make it far at all in the Olympics. I think he lost in the first round or so, but still, for only having a handful of fights, it's a pretty good accomplishment that he made the team. He turns pro soon after that, still staying in Canada. In Canada, it seems that, like, you know, to become the Canadian champion, especially for the heavyweight championship, you don't have to have a certain amount, like a ton of fights, to be able to contend for that title as much as if you just have a name. And Burbick, coming out of the Olympics, now settling in Canada, started to have a name after a few handful of fights. George Chavallo was still the Canadian heavyweight champion up until the mid-70s, which is pretty incredible considering his career had started in the, you know, in the late 50s or so. And mid-50s. And he was still talking, you know, still lingering around. And I don't know if he wasn't very active at that point, but he was still holding on to the title. Burbick, after winning a few pro fights, there was clamoring of him potentially fighting Chavallo for the title. Burbick, like you mentioned, him being very eccentric in the way he was, started really pushing for that fight and trying at every moment challenging Chavallo on, you know, really trying to push the buttons for that fight, to the point where, and this is pretty crazy, and this is something that would end up becoming more commonplace as we found out about Burbick and his personality later on, followed Chavallo and his wife while they were on vacation and in Halifax, I believe it was. And at that point, when him and his wife went to dinner or wherever they went, they left. Burbick took it upon himself to break into his hotel room because he wanted to meet Chavallo and everything. So he's sitting in there, and then Chavallo back walks into the room later on with his wife back into the room. All of a sudden, there's Trevor Burbick sitting there at a chair, smiling, that big grin that you've seen in photos of him and all that. And he said that he just wanted to sit there and talk with the champ and meet him. Chavallo flipped out and threw him out of his room, understandably. Probably should have attacked him at that point, too. I mean, what the hell, right?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't going to be knocking Chavallo out, that's for sure.
I mean, I'm saying, man, even at Chavallo's, you know, advanced age now, I'm sure no one's going to be decking the man. So, like, you know, I can imagine, Pat, put yourself in this position. You're walking with your wife, right? You know, I mean, you're a fighter or something like that, but you're walking into the back of your hotel with your wife. You open up the door and then you see a random dude just sitting over there smiling at you. How would you take that?
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't, right? You just, yeah. You know, fists start flying. You're not even going to think of something.
It'd be like Uncle Phil throwing jazz out the house, you know?
That's what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. Ah! Yeah, it'd be bad. No. The guy was... He had problems and they were even seemed to kind of manifest a little bit before, or at least started to, before he had gotten seriously into boxing. Although,
yeah,
as we get into the story, you can tell that they seem to be worsening as he fights more and more. But so very early on in his career. And so he turns professional and in his 12th pro fight, he loses to a guy named Bernardo Mercado.
Himself.
Yeah, Bernardo Mercado, a tough, hard-hitting dude from Colombia. He winds up scoring a first-round knockout over Trevor Burbick. And according to the news reports, with 3 seconds remaining, Mercado catches Burbick pulling backwards with his hands down and with a right hand, and he's out of it entirely. He hits the deck and, if not flat, unconscious. So the referee in the fight, a guy named Herb McMullen, he says he was down for the 10 count. In fact, he could have stayed down for a 20 count had we let it go on. I mean, he was talking a little bit of shit, I guess. But no, Bernardo Mercado was a pretty serious fighter. He was tough. He was definitely, I wouldn't call him a face-first fighter, but he was aggressive. He definitely came to scrap.
Tough guy, and he had decent skills, and he had a lot of power.
He had some length on his punches. He wasn't just a guy that like plowed forward and put his head down type of thing. He could catch you.
Contender. He almost fought Larry Holmes for the belt.
Yeah, he came very. He was one of those guys right around that time in the late 70s and early, late 70s specifically. I guess into the early 80s. I'd have to double check.
Yeah, I mean, he lost to Leon Spinks, I believe, in 1980, and that's when he was like. On the verge of
That would have been all right.
Very not so much in the early 80s,
but in the 70s for sure. Mm-hmm. So he actually, in the mid 70s, wound up showing up in Reno, Nevada, right around the time as Oscar Bonavena, because he came around the same time as Oscar Bonavena to be managed by Sally Conforte and be a sparring partner by him alongside Oscar Bonavena. So I know, I guess, a little bit more about Bernardo Mercado than the average boxing fan because of that. But I'm not like an expert or anything. Nonetheless, he was someone who also himself was not exactly averse to trouble. He'd known to get into a little bit of trouble himself and was known as somewhat of like a menacing figure.
I mean, he was part of that same era, bro. They all got in some kind of dabbling of some shit.
Yeah, that's true. And the characters he was involved with, it's like not surprising that he would get in some trouble. But in any case, he was a good fighter, and losing to him is not exactly a damning thing. And also, you got to take into account that over the course of Trevor Burbick's career, that knockout loss to Mercado and the knockout loss to Mike Tyson were his only two stoppage losses. And he fought some relatively bad mamma jammas, dude. I mean, just look at the list of, it's just a very brief list, to be honest, but it is a list of undefeated fighters that he handed their first defeat. Greg Page, Mitch Bloodgreen, Pinklin Thomas. And he fought both Larry Holmes and Mike Tyson when they were undefeated. So this isn't just some guy who's, you know, he's afraid to fight anybody. He's not taking on challenges. Mm-hmm. He was in there in the mix. He wasn't just some fringe guy.
Whenever he lost, it was, and this is another thing that would add to his character as it went on, especially as you mentioned how he got more erratic later on as fights went on and stuff like that. He mentioned after this fight against Bernardo Mercado, when he was knocked out in the first round, he claimed that it was women trouble. He wasn't ready for the fight. He mentally wasn't there. He had a lot going on, and that he said that someone might have put something in the water, whatever. And he said that in the first round, he went out there. He said, I had Mercado hurt. I had him bleeding. I was beating him up. He said, I dropped my hands briefly for 1 second to step back. Like you said, he got caught like that way. And he was like, the fight was over. He said, when I got up, I was ready to fight. He was like, when I came to, that never happened to me before. And he was like, all I wanted to do was fight. And I'm sure that was the case, but he would always have a random excuse for things. So after that fight, which is a setback by me, like you mentioned, not a major one, because Mercado was around at that point, a high quality contender, number one contender, so on. But Berbick struggled a little bit. He still wasn't able to break the mold. He never got the Chavalo fight that he coveted. And he was still being erratic. Like, you know, he went a couple of fights, but then he struggled and go to a draw with a tough, like, journeyman like Leroy Caldwell. And it wasn't until his fight with John Tate where his fortunes really changed. Big John Tate, another doomed for
poor John Tate.
Yeah, you know, poor John Tate, very much so. Another doomed soul who had a dark future ahead of him, but at that point was only one fight removed from being WBA heavyweight champion and a fight with Muhammad Ali. So the stage was set. Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, June Montreal, biggest fight of the year at that point, probably, right? And the undercard was going to feature the comeback of John Tate. So the backstory to this and how Trevor Berbick equates to this is that Don King and Bob Arum were co-promoting this show. Don King with Roberto Duran, Bob Arum obviously with Sugar Ray, you know, representing Leonard and in behalf of Mike Trainer, all that stuff. So long story short, Bob Arum tried to one-up Don King by taking over the entire promotion. And when they were supposed to help match make the undercard fights together, Bob Arum went above Don King and made all the fights on his own without Don King knowing anything about it, basically cutting him out of the entire card aside from the main event. Don King got really mad about that, obviously, and was looking for a way to get some revenge. So they're looking through the list, whatever. And that's when you mentioned the guy earlier, Tom McCluskey, got a call, and he was Bob Arum had called him up, hey, you still have that bum Berbick? Yeah, we still represent him. Okay, we're going to use him to fight John Tate. Don King gets his wins of this. Al Braverman, who was Don King's matchmaker at the time, decides, hey, you know what? They signed Trevor Berbick without anyone knowing about it. So they put Trevor Berbick in a camp, put him in with the best sparring possible, get him really – Berbick at this point now, if you know, he showed potential, but he was stuck in the doldrums of just local scene and not really getting the best out of his abilities for that. Now he's getting quality sparring under the, you know, with Don King fronting this because Don King is thinking about revenge. He's getting quality sparring, getting quality training, nutrients, whatever you want to call it, but he's in tip top shape. Big John Tate, on the other hand, is still dealing with the mental faculties of getting absolutely obliterated in his last fight against Mike Weaver and still dealing with that and so on and so forth. What transpires is a very grueling, interesting fight between a guy that should have been controlling it and John Tate, who's still struggling and getting bullied and bodied by a brawler, but a brutish, but still skilled in his own way, Trevor Berbick, who's really, you know, putting on the performance of his career at that point. So fast forward all the way to around the 8th, 9th round now. Tate is spent, he's beat up, he's getting worn out and everything, and Berbick is really, really feeling it. Last round comes up, I think it was around the 9th. Berbick gets up and he's pumps chest, and he's there, bow, 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 bow. Like, he's hyped, you know what I mean? You look at Tate, he looks bewildered, he looks scared, he looks just, and you know, really like he shouldn't even come off his stool, they shouldn't have allowed him out. Round starts, Berbick comes out there, pop, pop, hits him with a combination. Tate starts running away, and it's an incredible scene to see. If you listen to this show, you've probably seen it, but like, Tate starts running away, like he literally turns his back and runs away. Berbick clumsily chases after him, and then hits him with like a combination with like a right hand that hits Tate in the back of the head. Tate collapses the same way he did in the Weaver fight, completely unconscious and his leg is twitching. Berbick does his Muhammad Ali impression, slapping him, get up, sucker, get up, you know, yelling at him, and gets pulled away. Tate gets counted out, and if you watch closely, and it's actually kind of funny to see, unfortunately what happened to Tate, but it's funny to see this scene. If you watch closely, as you see the ringside, you see Don King going absolutely apeshit in hysterics, cheering, going, yeah, like, wiling out, right? Because he knew he got one over on Arum. And then in the Four Kings book, the great book by George Kimball, writes, you know, he looked over and King and said, don't tell me you got him too. And King went, yep, and started cheering on. So at that point, from there, Trevor Berbick's fortunes completely changed. And that's how he left his original trainer, McCluskey, and signed on with Don King, and the 80s came on.
Yeah, and with that, a lot of nonsense and sometimes not much good. But that was definitely a brutal end for John Tate, unfortunately. I mean, we might wind up having to do like some sort of John Tate episode at some point, because
I'm gonna say this, man. Career. If you look back on it, if you look on that fight, that is one of the more depressing fights of the entire era. If you realize the futures of both of those fights,
exactly. Yeah,
it's really, you're just like, holy
exactly.
shit, really heavy.
Yeah, it's and it's unfortunate too, because there were a couple moments in the fight where John Tate like doesn't look very bad at all. It's just that he winds up getting early worn out.
He was mentally worn out.
Later in the fights, he just couldn't hack it. He was too big. He was too like clumsy, uncoordinated. He just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, man, he goes down just in an absolute heap from getting hit in the back. You got the Frank Bruno special, dude. He got
oof.
Frank Bruno and his rabbit punches. Completely
clobbered, man. And it's scary to see him laying there unconscious and his leg is twitching the way it was.
Yeah, it's brutal, dude. It's a pretty... But so that fight, like you said, is kind of where his fortunes changed and where a lot of things changed for him. Basically, that all of a sudden, he kind of moved into contendership like after that fight. And he winds up landing in 1981 and the spring of 1981, a shot against Larry Holmes, who was the WBC heavyweight champion. And I mean, basically at that time, Larry Holmes, he was not in a decline yet, but Larry Holmes, despite being how good he was, and he was, I'm definitely not arguing that. There were a number of fights where he just didn't look stellar. It was like you needed to push him. Like you needed to like start kicking his ass or something like that to really get him to open up. And not all the time. It was almost like you need to piss him off somehow, because some fighters pissed him off pre-fight. And that was like, oh, that was, you know, that's it, dude. Don't piss Larry off. And some of them did it during the fight and same result. That was don't fucking piss Larry off. But Trevor Burbick didn't really have that kind of punch, didn't really have that kind of danger. There were only like a couple of rounds really where he did fairly well, but for the most part, it was just a lackluster fight. And that's how it was reported as well. And Trevor Burbick after the fight is, you know, moaning and wailing and all sorts of stuff about the, you know, he was like an excuse making expert, dude.
Yes, just, and it was like ridiculous excuses too. Always.
There are fighters that are just outstanding at it. And he's just fantastic at making excuses, or was. And so in any case, it actually, I didn't think, was a terrible showing for Trevor Burbick, considering the level that Larry Holmes was on. Well,
He was the first opponent. He was the first challenger to go to distance with Holmes at that point. You know, and that was no easy feat. And Holmes certainly didn't like him. You know, like at that point, like you mentioned, like Holmes, he pissed him off. Burbick was talking a lot of shit during the fight. Holmes shoves him a couple of, like, it was not no fault.
Yeah, it was early in the fight. Yeah.
Yeah. Holmes was definitely like wanted to knock him out, but.
The first or second round, I can't remember which one it was, but early in the fight, Trevor Burbick, like after the round, he starts jawing at him and Larry Holmes like shoves the shit out of him.
Yeah.
And I mean, I that's just kind of like how Larry Holmes was though. Like, I mean, if you push him, start messing with him, rabbit punching him, like
Holmes was a street dude at heart, man. He absolutely was. He was a very tough guy, as you know, when he got up from Ernie Shavers. But I mean, like, he's just a very street dude at heart that I'm sure we'll get to in a little bit. More with another MC with Burbick, but like, don't piss off Holmes. All right, Holmes had no problem. You saw another press conferences with Jerry Cooney and other guys. He had no problem getting up and trying to swing on somebody if he felt like he was being wronged.
Yeah,
right. He even slapped Muhammad Ali in the face after his fight with Scott LeDoux. So,
yeah, and that was another thing with Larry Holmes, was he was liable to get his dander up when somebody else was fighting and he was attending. And one of those people might wind up fighting him one day. He was going to be on the sideline, possibly taking some poor Jerry Cooney. He's getting swung on. And yeah, it was bad. But no, that's when their feud started, was the trash talk during and I guess after the fight. Trevor Burbick was saying stuff like, never hit me hard. He never hurt me. He doesn't really hit that hard. Didn't do nothing, stuff like that. And that's kind of, like I said, that kind of stuff just riles Larry Holmes up. And that started a feud between them. That was back in 1981. But even so, Larry Holmes, despite the fact that that's Larry Holmes, Trevor Burbick only moved up in the world in terms of notoriety. But I mean, possibly not in a good way by fighting and defeating Muhammad Ali. He had the unfortunate distinction of being Muhammad Ali's, you know, swan song opponent. And Muhammad Ali had already looked awful before that, like well before that. And this wound up being a clear indication that Muhammad Ali like should have quit years ago. So Trevor Burbick, despite the fact that he loses to Larry Holmes, is led into this Muhammad Ali fight.
Yeah, and he wasn't even supposed to be the original opponent. You know, when Ali lost to Holmes, like you said, that was one of the most abysmal, saddest, pathetic, depressing fights in boxing history. And Ali had no business getting back in the ring after that, obviously. And you know, he still did. And there was a lot going on with that afterwards. You know, Ali was denied licenses in Vegas, basically all over America. And he even tried to get a license in Hawaii at one point, that which is not really known as a boxing hotbed, and they even rejected it. So that gives you, you know, how much of what Ali was going through. And there was always rumors of various opponents who Ali was going to fight. All right, you know, Ali was going to fight this guy, a cruiserweight one at one point, named Willie the Cannon Shannon. Ali was going to fight Scott Ledoux. Ali was going to fight Big John Tate, had he, instead of Larry Holmes, actually, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Mike
Weaver. There was rumors of Ali fighting Mike Weaver. And then the main guy and the main name that was going around before Trevor Burbick got the gig was a British heavyweight by the name of John L. Gardner. And John L. Gardner was a tough middling fighter at the time, you know, maybe a little fringe contender. Anytime he really stepped up against the likes of like Michael Doakes or, you know, someone of the like that, he got blasted out. But he was a good fighter in the UK scene. And there was a lot of talk about him fighting John L. Gardner, especially in Hawaii. That was the main one at that point. After all of that fell apart, that's when Trevor Burbick's name came in there. And the guy who put the fight together was a hanger-on of the Ali circle by the name of James Cornelius. And Cornelius was just, you know, a crazy huckster, shyster. There's so many different words you can use for him, but he was also a part of Ali's inner circle, being, you know, he was part of the Muslim Nation of Islam along with Ali, and had been around him for a number of years too. So after enough convincing, other stuff, they were able to bring the fight to Nassau in the Bahamas. And that was so much of a shit show that they wrote a book on it, okay? Called right here, which is a great book, by the way, called The Drama in the Bahamas. And by Dave Hannigan. And we could do a whole show on that entire promotion, how bad that was. From Don King getting his ass kicked, which is a hilarious story in itself, by Cornelius and his thugs. And, you know, I should tell you that right now. Like, so Don King, who obviously was taking care of Trevor Burbick, had nothing to do with this fight. Cornelius was taking care of it, all this other stuff. Don King, of course, seeing money that that's not being made for himself, wants to needle in on it. So he flew personally to the Bahamas to try to stop it. Cornelius and his goons and his own bodyguards met King at his hotel, closed the door, and beat the living shit out of him. Okay, like, they beat Don King, you know, because Don King's out of America now. He doesn't have anybody there to protect him. He's on his own, which was kind of dumb on himself to do that. And these guys beat him to a pulp and then basically sent him back to America saying, if you want to step in again, you're gonna die. And King didn't do anything with it. He actually left it alone because he knew better. So the fight ends up getting made. And like you said, man, Ali did look better, I guess, in the Burbick fight than he did against Holmes, which isn't saying much because like Ali was literally a walking corpse in the Holmes fight. So the fact that he was able to throw some punches together and all the other stuff, you know, he was a little bit more competitive. He showed slight flashes here and there, landing the combination, because Burbick obviously is not Larry Holmes either. He was a crude guy like that. So but Burbick did what he did. He bullied Ali, rushed him to the ropes, beat him down, beat him up. He just, you know, and it was a clear-cut decision. And at the end of the day, it added, I'm not sure how much it added to Burbick's reputation of being a world beater, but it did give him the biggest name, you know, in a footnote.
Right. Yeah, give him a big name, give him a big payday, and a lot of notoriety. But I think maybe
He did tell Ali after the fight, you made me. He kept on yelling that out to him afterwards.
Well, he wasn't lying. Yeah. And I think similarly to, obviously not the same, but similarly to like maybe how Rocky Marciano took out Joe Lewis, like kind of a nail in the coffin type of thing, where we've already seen this fighter look old. We've already seen them look not great anymore, or weathered, too weathered, not just slower or whatever, but weathered. And now they need to be put out to pasture with like a definitive defeat. And this was it. Although, like you said, he didn't look as awful against Holmes. He looked absolutely terrible. But all of the drama surrounding this, and when it comes to the Don King thing, it's funny, dude, because having lived in another country, even though it wasn't for super long time, it just seems like it's almost like you see it in movies or shows or something like that, where American thugs go to another country and they have to learn like what the fuck real thuggery is about.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they got to learn the hard way, like what the fuck being a gangster really is, like in a different country in the slums and shit. And that's not to say that's exactly what happened or what happened in Nassau per se, like they went into some shack or some shit. But the point is, it's different when you're not at home and when you're not like, oh, I'll just call the police, you know, like, no, it's that ain't like that, dude. And so
it was so, like, when I say about the shady goings on in the fight, like, it was so bad. Cornelius was, they had no money, they had to like fund money at the last moment, they had no the arena was a shim sham, there was like the gloves were bad. Poor Thomas Hearns, first fight out from the Sugar Ray Leonard fight, suffered a gnarly cut against Ernie Singletary. And they had no one on hand to really treat him or anything like that. I think after the fight, Angelo Dundee and a few people just kind of stitched Hearns up in the locker room on their own. Ernie Shavers wasn't paid at first, and to the point where he
had to be brave enough. Who's going to be brave enough to not pay Ernie Shavers?
I'm saying. And so Ernie Shavers, the story goes that Ernie Shavers confronted James Cornelius, threw him in a room and locked the door and said, unless you're Spider-Man, you're not getting out of this room until I get my money.
And he got his money.
And he got his money, obviously.
Well, I mean, like I said, like, I don't know.
And of course, to top it all off, Muhammad Ali's career ended with the bell being a cowbell.
You know, I'm sorry. I apologize for doing this again, but there's actually a part in my book, the Oscar Bonavena book,
when he
fights in Germany, and he fought not Jürgen Blin, what's the guy's name, the German
Mildenberger?
Dude,
Carl
Mildenberger. I don't know why I was drawing a blank, probably because smoke way too much weed. But in any case, he fought Carl Mildenberger, and even the title of the Sports Illustrated article written about the fight is called A Bean Can Bout in Frankfurt, because they wound up having to use a bean can and go on the bean can for a bell, to the point where nobody could hear the bell several different times during. It was like a total shit show of a promotion. So it just to illustrate that it's not the first time it's happened. I'm sure it isn't the last time that's happened. We've actually heard in recent years there have been bells that are like smack, you know, like they don't shit like that. And that's just bad form, you know, shitty preparation and stuff, but also to illustrate how poorly this promotion was put together. But it was also the drama in the Bahamas was the nickname that the promotion was given. Mm-hmm. But it wound up becoming far more infamous because of Ali and the punishment that he took, because it was his last fight, and also because of the really bad publicity that it got during the time. I mean, a number of different things.
I said by everywhere. Yeah, everyone shammed it. It was a complete sham.
It was, yeah, it just didn't go well. It didn't go well at all. And so kind of fast forwarding a little bit so that we can get to some of the actual criminal behavior here. But well, it's important to go over the big fights too. It's important to go over like the kind of career changing fights and whatnot. But in 1983, so a few fights after the Larry Holmes fight and the Muhammad Ali fights, he winds up losing to Ronaldo Snipes, who, again, it's kind of like, all right, well, Snipes is probably the level of fighter where if you're elite, you should be beating him somewhat comfortably. But fine, you have an off night, you could see somebody losing to Snipes. Immediately after that, he loses to, yeah, of just one of those kind of weird who the hell is that type of things, where he loses to a guy named ST Gordon. And anyway, so years after that fight, Burbick claimed that not only did someone poison the food that he ate in Las Vegas in the days leading to the fight, but that somebody actually sprayed poison gas into his hotel room to make it so that he couldn't sleep. And I mean,
you would always say shit like this. Those were like two of his good lines too. But he
did the poisoned food thing like several different times, but then he like did, I'm just wondering, did anybody ever think to ask him if that poisoned gas to make him not sleep was cocaine?
I mean, it's the 80s. Dude, yeah, man. But like but like you said, the loss to Snipes is excusable to a degree. Snipes,
well, and sorry to interrupt you, yeah. But he actually said that he was poisoned after that. He was poisoned before that fight too. Later on, when they're going like at a different point in his career, they're going over what happened in this fight, what happened in this fight, and he goes, starts talking about how they poisoned his hotel room after the ST Gordon fight, but that after the Snipes fight, before the Snipes fight, his food was poisoned. So he used this several different times.
But that was always him, like you said earlier, about being erratic. You know what I mean? Like, he was a very erratic guy. And it wasn't even so much fighting to the level of his competition so much that you just really didn't know what the hell kind of Burbick would show up. It was like...
mentally, whatever.
Mentally, whatever. And that really showed it there because, like you said, Snipes, he was an underdog in that fight. And Burbick probably should have beat him, if we're being serious here, but... You know, Snipes also could spring an upset when he needed to. And he beat Burbick up that fight. I think he dropped him in the first and kind of, you know, commanded him. ST Gordon is a lot more as a head scratcher. Don't get me wrong. ST Gordon as a cruiserweight knocked out Carlos De Leon. He wasn't a bad fighter or anything. But as a heavyweight, he did absolutely nothing. And I think his claim to fame before that was being extremely undersized against Jerry Cooney and being DQ'd out of it. So him beating Burbick was a huge upset, where the point where everyone would be like, well, we know his ceiling and he's not going to do anything else with that. Like, Burbick was basically written off after that fight.
Well, and you could easily see why he could be. And he winds up fighting back in Jamaica. So it's obviously he's kind of like traveling around. He fights in the UK, he fights in Jamaica. It's kind of becoming something of a journeyman after that fight. Having to go around and coming from getting paid from a Muhammad Ali fight, it's almost like throughout his career, Muhammad Ali, there weren't many, but there were fighters that he fought where you almost look and you see, you're like, what? I don't remember that fight at all. Alvin Blue Lewis, Mac Foster. I mentioned Jurgen Blinn before. That's probably why. But there are those fights where you're just like, what? I don't remember anything about that fight. What are you talking? I don't remember that fight didn't happen. And, you know, it's a little bit different with Trevor Burbick because it was his final fight. So Burbick was obviously far more memorable and got that payday. But then going from that to just basically being a journeyman was a pretty big change. And then he winds up working his way back in the WBC rankings by picking up the USBA heavyweight title, which, you know, we've talked about this before. Like I said, he beat a couple of undefeated fighters in Mitch Blood Green, and he wound up defeating Pinklin Thomas for his belt. But what led to that is that some of these other fringe belts, USBA, NABF type of, they're like satellite belts for the larger organizations. And so then when they wind up winning these kind of fringe or smaller belts, that gets them higher in the rankings for these bigger organizations.
Especially back then. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was a little bit more clear cut back then as far as what happened. But in any case, he gets that shot against Pinklin Thomas and picks up a portion of the heavyweight title that obviously Mike Tyson wanted.
For sure. And at that point, too, that was a huge upset because Thomas, even though he had a lot of out-of-the-ring issues that I don't think the world really knew about at that point, was looked upon as maybe the future of the division, or at least the guy that might have been the favorite of
Looked good.
Yeah.
You know, like a very physically imposing type of guy.
Incredible jab. He's a very underrated fighter, all right? Yeah. Because again, he had a lot of drug issues that came out afterwards and other stuff too that he was dealing with. But like, fact of the matter is, when he was on his game and he could fight, he was a very, very formidable fighter. Like you said, fast hands, good skills, good combinations, had a really, really good jab, good right hand behind it. And he had good power to go along with his boxing skills. Like, he knocked the shit out of Mike Weaver in a very good knockout. Won the WBC title, a very commanding decision over Tim Witherspoon. He looked like maybe possibly the future of the division at that point around 1986, before Tyson really, you know, was coming on. So for him to lose to Burbick like that, who was still, even though he was on a nice run, but still considered a step below a guy like Thomas, that was considered a big upset. And Burbick at that point was trained by Eddie Futch for that fight, should be mentioned too.
Yeah, he went through a handful of trainers. He was trained by Angelo Dundee, Eddie Futch, that guy Lee McCluskey. Black. What's that?
Lee Black, who came after McCluskey,
He was, I mean, that's just two of those trainers are very notable, high quality, world-class trainers. And I don't know enough about the other ones to say they're good or bad. I'm sure
I won't say that, Futch was actually quoted in the KO Magazine interview years later, because he said that he was like, I'm not going to name the fighter, but there was one guy who I did not want to work with. They kept on bothering me to work with him, blah, blah, blah. I just knew I didn't like his attitude. I didn't, you know, this and that, but I didn't want to work with him. He was like, finally, I agreed with him just for one fight and one fight only, because I thought he had a chance for it. And so we worked with it. I struggled, but I got him through the camp and then we won. And they were like, finally, who is it? He was like, ah, it's Trevor Burbick. And and after that fight, he was like, I said afterwards, when that fight ended, I already saw the way he was acting and other stuff. And he was like, I'm done. I'm never going to work with him again. And they asked him about the Tyson fight and he said he wasn't interested. And they asked him too, do you think you would have beat Tyson even if you were in his corner? He said, no.
Well, and unfortunately for Trevor Burbick, he wound up suffering an extremely memorable knockout loss in that fight, even if it was his only other knockout loss. Pretty memorable.
It's not even one that needs to be rehashed, because it's been so well, you know, documented and shown all over throughout the years. But I did watch the broadcast, the original HBO broadcast, because the one that's always shown on television, the one with Sheridan, Bob Sheridan, you know, doing the commentary for it. But watching the original HBO broadcast with the intro of it, where they use, like, I forgot the song about, like, the cheesiest 80s music, really popular, you can find, of Tyson knocking dudes out and then doing the little mini intros of Burbick and Tyson, the pre-shows and all that. It's pretty awesome. I'm not even going to lie. Up until the fight. But, and everybody that was in ringside for that it was really impressive. That was a big, big event, because people knew that was going to be a Tyson coronation. So the who's who of Hollywood there was there. All the big fighters were there. You know, it was a big event. And then Tyson did what he needed to do and blasted Burbick. But that was probably, I will say this, that was one, not only the beginning of the end for Burbick as a contender and just in his career, even though he would fight for a number of years afterwards, this was also when a lot of his real erratic behavior outside of the ring started taking place. And I'll let you elaborate on that, Pat.
Yeah, I think that was really the point at which his behavior started becoming far more dangerous and violent, and also his career got more erratic as well. But before we do that, I actually have to pause for a moment, because I have to say a little bit of a word about our sponsor, Manscaped. So look, support for Knuckles and Gloves is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below the waist grooming. And look, they're the champions of the world when it comes to this stuff. Look, it offers precision and it offers well-engineered tools for, look, your family jewels, man. Manscaped was launched their fourth trimmer, the Lawnmower 4.0. And look, you heard that right. That's four. They've already had three before this, and they're on the fourth iteration of below the waist trimmer. So join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. And this is an exclusive offer, 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code GLOVE, GLOVE at manscaped.com. One of the cool things about this tool also is that it's wireless. So you don't wind up having to trip over wires and stuff like that in the bathroom. I mean, more wires in the bathroom sucks. There's water. We've seen horror stories.
You get a bunch of essential oils.
Yep. It comes with a number of essential oils so that you can prime your balls to be trimmed, but then also the after the trim soothing, it's pretty nice. But it's also having an exclusive trimmer for your nether regions. I'm just being honest, dude. Look, you don't want to use the same trimmer down there that you use on your face or your head. You just, come on.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, man. So if you just cut out that,
it's unfortunate, but
specifically for below the belt, it works out perfect.
Yeah, it unfortunately does happen. So we're going to have to avoid this situation by getting
Manscaped
Lawn Mower 4.0. So again, get 20% off and free shipping with the code GLOVE. That's GLOVE at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. If you use the code GLOVE, unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. Back to Trevor Burbick. Look, that Mike Tyson fight obviously derailed not only his career, but outside of the ring. It was bad news bears, man. He, before that fight, was able to string together a number of wins. After that fight, it was like a few wins, a few losses, a few wins, a few losses for pretty much the rest of his career. But what wound up happening was, actually, I didn't know this, but in 1990, Trevor Burbick was one of Mike Tyson's sparring partners in Tokyo. I mean, I knew some of them, but I didn't know he was among them.
Didn't know that either.
Yeah, they did interviews and go ahead.
His last notable fight in terms of like contendership was against Carl the Truth Williams, you know, around that time. So I think that was around 88. Actually, no, that was in 88, I think, on the undercard of Tyson Spinks. And that was probably his last like major fight on like a big platform like that. So yeah. All right. I didn't know that he was in Tokyo that's news to me. It's interesting.
Well, he loses to Carl Spinks, or I'm sorry, Carl Williams.
Yeah,
Carl Williams, and then he loses to Buster Douglas, and then he fights Jeff Sims, and it's like, you know, that's like pretty much the end of the normal guys for
Jeff Sims and, you know, Trevor Burbick together. Talk about an interesting combination. Yeah,
well, there was a pretty clear shift in his career after that, where he wasn't really thought of as a top guy at all. And so in any case, in 1989 and 1990, Larry Holmes fights a handful. I'm going to hand it back to you for this one, but Larry Holmes fights a handful of exhibition bouts. And after one of them, something incredible happened. Eris, you want to tell us a little bit about a limo?
Trevor Burbick showed up.
A drop kick. And Jenny from Jacksonville.
Exactly. Trevor Burbick shows up. All right. Trevor Burbick doesn't like Larry Holmes. Larry Holmes doesn't like Trevor Burbick. Larry Holmes, I think, was a Tim Doc Anderson that he had just stopped, or one of the fighter around that time. Might have been.
I can't remember, but it was like he was fighting a number of exhibitions, and it was right around the same time he fought an exhibition.
So wins his fight, Trevor Burbick, full suit on, shows up, and is causing a scene at the post-fight press conference. And he's yelling at Larry Holmes' wife, which was a big no-no, because you know how like devoted Holmes is to his wife. And he's yelling at anyone in general who can listen to him about how Larry Holmes has ruined his marriage. Larry Holmes has ruined his life. Larry Holmes has sent hookers and other people like Jenny from Jacksonville over to mess with him and try to screw everything up. And just, it's a big, big mess. It's all on video, but it's absolutely hilarious. And Trevor Burbick is causing a gigantic scene about how Larry Holmes has ruined everything in his life. And he wants to fight him. And if they want a street fight, in the words of Trevor Burbick, if they want to do a street fight, he'll break all the ribs in his body easily. You know what I mean? So Holmes actually wasn't even aware of this at first. He caught wind that Burbick was over there, and that's when shit started. Because Holmes, I think, was still in the arena, and that's when Burbick was causing hell in the back, and people were videotaping her, and Burbick was threatening and saying that Jenny from Jacksonville ruined everything, and Larry Holmes ruined my life, and you ruined my marriage, and my kids are depressed, and everybody, and, you know, Larry Holmes is the reason why my life sucks, in a nutshell, right?
And again, this is like 10 years after their fight.
This is the early 90s now. Burbick, at this point, like you mentioned, has already started to have some brushes with the law, because it started around the 90s. Like, he's getting really erratic here, and he's clearly off his rocker at this point. Holmes catches wind of it. Long story short, he meets up with Burbick, and he tries to attack him off the jump because, like we mentioned earlier in the show, Holmes is street. Holmes has no problem trying to swing on you. He doesn't. This is the stuff he does, especially if you're trying to attack him verbally, you know, about his character, and you're coming at his wife talking shit. Like, he's not going to take that. You know what I mean? Even today, I'm sure if he said something to his wife, he'll swing at you. So, he came at Burbick and he tried swinging on him. And of course, you know, Holmes hit him and they got into a scuffle right away, right? And so now they're outside because it spilled outside. The whole confrontation spills outside. And they get into a scuffle and it gets broken apart and stuff like that. And now you see Trevor Burbick being held by various people. And Trevor Burbick starts yelling, "Larry Holmes! Larry Holmes kicked me and punched me! He kicked me and punched me! Kicked me, punched me!" You know, yelling about that. Before you know it, you hear a commotion. Larry Holmes, like this is WrestleMania, comes jumping on top of a car in a hardcore match or some shit, comes running on top of a car and jumps off the roof of it and hits a flying drop kick on Trevor Burbick. It's one of the most absurd, awesome things you'll ever see.
That's one of the most hilarious things about it is that before it even happens or you could hear or see anything about Larry Holmes, mm-hmm. you hear like a crowd go, "Ah!" like yeah. that. And then you hear thump, thump, thump because he's like stomping across cars or something like that.
And he scaled that shit great, man. He climbed across the car and got all the way to the top.
He didn't
and
give a shit.
Right off of it. Like, and this funny thing, like Holmes was wearing a sweatsuit, like he was ready for some action, you know what I mean? And he just and he just jumped and pow, and you see him collide with Burbick with feet first, and then they both go down, and the whole thing is just a big schmoz after that gets breaking up. But Holmes,
like this fucking guy is over here talking mad shit, and then he's like, "He's attacking me." Like,
bro, and all of a sudden, you just see a flying Larry Holmes, which is just, oh my god, man. If only we could have been there, if anyone could have been there, if this happened during the fact that it's still relevant today, and this happened in the early 90s where it could be forgotten about, and it's still, whenever someone posts that clip, it still almost gets semi-viral depending on who posts it, you know what I mean? And imagine if that something like that happened during today, during the internet age, during the age of like everybody records everything. Oh my God. You know how many platforms that would have been on at that time and how many things that would have blown up? You just see him Burbick, eyes bugging out of his head the way he was yelling, saying Larry Holmes kicked me and punched me and he attacked me, and then he comes up.
shouldn't have mentioned Jenny from Jacksonville. You know what I'm saying? Don't bring up Jenny. It was an extremely memorable scene and definitely makes the top whatever press conference,
because not even press conference, for a rematch, you know? With Holmes too, you know, he wanted to fight Holmes and Holmes was like, I don't want to fight him, he has no business. But I'll leave it at this with their rivalry. Larry Holmes was interviewed for Vlad TV, and when he's asked about Trevor Burbick, he goes, "God don't like ugly. He's resting, but I don't know if it's in peace."
Larry, dude. I mean, I love Larry, but he's definitely among the more bitter people.
Yeah, Larry don't give a damn, man. You know what I mean? Well, I know he never, ever got over the fact that he had to do a flying drop kick on Trevor Burbick, so...
I don't blame him. You know, he holds a grudge and he cherishes that fucking grudge.
Mm-hmm,
but so not too long after this, or right around the same time, but I think it would have been a little after this. So in March of 1990, Trevor Burbick was arrested in Florida for allegedly taking a woman at a bank hostage and ordering her at gunpoint to help him look for his then estranged wife. So before that incident, apparently there had been something that happened between Trevor and his wife in Las Vegas that she apparently left him. I couldn't find anything specifying what that was, but obviously some sort of fight or altercation happened. And so after that, Trevor's wife left him, and wherever she went, he didn't know. And so I guess he thought that holding this lady up at the bank at gunpoint was the way he was going to figure it out.
This was the start of it, man. And it only
kind of bad here. Yeah, kind of bad. And then in 1991, again in Florida, Burbick was arrested and charged with sexual assault of his family's babysitter. And he allegedly went to the babysitter's house to pay her her babysitting fees, and then raped her, allegedly. But it sounds like the jury was extremely convinced. Burbick said the charges were bogus, however, and that they were made up by his wife, who was, he said, was upset with him. I mean, that's quite the fucking crazy and shit again, to do.
This was the thing, bro. It was that, like, he would always, and this is what's really disturbing about his things, is that he was, everything that he ended up doing outside of the ring, crazy shit, he had one of those built-in weird excuses for it, just like he did after he would lose a fight.
Yeah.
Which clearly showed that he had something going on in his head.
Yeah, there was, it was obvious that he was fairly incapable of taking responsibility for the stuff that he did and said, and whatever the reason for that was,
considering what, you know, the stuff that he was doing afterwards, because it was almost like, as you're gonna, you know, you'll go on saying the more stuff that he did, but like it almost seemed like he wasn't even aware, just like with the things, and that, like, he, you know, his justifications, he was so built in with this belief of what that happened, that, like, you know.
And he kept coming back to religion too. He kept saying stuff about, like, he was wanted to be a preacher, and he was a man of God, and he was a Christian and stuff like that. But then later in 1991 was a bad fucking year for Trevor Burbick, man. But later in 1991, toward the end of the year, he was charged with mortgage fraud and grand theft because he supposedly had someone go into a bank impersonating his wife to try to take out a second mortgage on their home. I mean, you know, like I said, it gets pretty intense. But so anyway, somehow Trevor Burbick only serves a little over a year for these crimes. It's awful. It's kind of a miscarriage of justice there. But in 1997, you'll like this one. And this one is at least not violent. But in 1997, his parole officer reports that he hasn't been checking in monthly, as he was legally obligated to do. And Burbick refused to say where he was. And then in June, as he was about to board a plane to Canastota for the International Boxing Hall of Fame for that weekend, the cops step in and grab him at the airport.
Oh, snap. Wow. What year was this, 97?
This was 1997.
Aye, aye. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, somehow
I think, there's, well, a Canastota. I think 97 was the year that Don King was inducted, actually. I might be wrong.
So maybe Don put in the call.
Well, because around that time, I think it was, whatever year it was, 96, 97, that was the year that Don King had literally, they said that was the most amount of world champions, because Don literally brought his entire roster and all of the past champions involved that he ever promoted, whatever it was, to Canastota that weekend. They said it was to the point, and I can only imagine how crazy this must have been. They said it was to the point where you saw more former champions and former fighters than you saw fans because of how many people Don brought in.
God, so the ratio of people who had been robbed by Don King went way, way up that weekend.
Yeah. And he flew them in. I guess that was his way of, like, I have no idea. It's just crazy. But, you know, in between all of those things that he went through, Burbick, he was still fighting infrequently. I mean, not often, but he was still fighting in the 90s. And he was a part of those, you know, like we've talked before on the show and just in general about the leftovers from the lost generation of the 80s heavyweights who still fought in the 90s, early 90s, mid 90s, still had relative success here and there. Guys like Tim Witherspoon, Tony Tubbs, Greg Page, and Trevor Burbick, for that matter. Burbick was around and he was fighting guys like Melvin Foster, who he beat, Jimmy Thunder, who I think, which was on Tuesday Night Fights, probably, Hasim Rahman. And Burbick was going the distance with all these guys. No one was able to knock him out. He was still a serviceable former champion. Funny to look at because he was about as fat as Frankie Swindell at that point. Like, he had blown up and was really portly, but still had the savviness and wherewithal or whatever to, you know, to be a serviceable opponent to these up and come, you know, to the prospects and fringe contenders of the 90s.
Frankie While Swindell. Going through
all the craziness of what you were, you know, describing.
Frankie Swindell is a good name drop, dude, because it's like a fighter nobody ever talks about. Started at like light heavyweight and was like actually a pretty good fighter, but then lost a couple times and just blew up.
Became a bowling ball.
But one that like was still difficult as shit to fight, but
absolutely. Man, there was nothing funnier to watch than seeing Swindell's big ass belly and seeing him like swivel it, moving away and like deflecting punches and stuff on Friday Night Fights in the early 2000s.
Yeah, man, he was a pain in the ass. But you know, the Trevor Burbick saga does not end there. Like you said, he's still fighting, but it's very infrequently. And then in his final fight, after his final fight in the year 2000, he winds up getting an MRI or like some sort of CT scan that reveals he has a blood clot in his brain that forces him to retire because he can't get license after that. After that, it's like nobody's going to license him because nobody wants to take the liability of potentially putting a dude in with a brain clot in there and he dies and they're, you know, on the hook. I mean, that's a grim way of looking at it, but that's just the truth. And in any case, so like I said, like with this whole saga does not end back where he retires. So in 1997, actually, rewinding slightly, Trevor Burbick is deported to Canada after he's released from jail. And somehow he makes his way back into the U.S. and he's deported back to Jamaica in 2002 because the U.S. is like, we don't even know how the hell you got into the country. Like, we're not sending you to Canada this time because Canada doesn't want you either. Get out and go to Jamaica.
Imagine you're so crazy and it's wild that you get deported from not just one but two different countries.
Yeah, it's kind of rough, dude. I mean, needless to say, he was not in a good place here at the end of his career. And
let me ask you this then. When do you think he was suffering? I mean, clearly he had something going on. Do you think he was suffering from brain damage up from like the early 90s that started all this stuff? Do you think he had some kind of imbalance to begin with that like just taking the punishment in his career certainly didn't help it?
Well, I mean, based on the kind of stories that he tells, it sounds like he probably had something going on mental illness wise early on in life. I could be wrong and I don't want to like trash the guy because I know that that's still like taboo
to
a lot of people
like that, but I mean I'm just curious, like I mean there was something just off
I think that's safe to say. I think it's at some point, whether it was like a chemical imbalance, a mental illness, or that something was, you know, as they say colloquially, even though it's not, you know, totally true, something got knocked loose in the ring. I don't know, but something was wrong with him. You know,
they have a long career as well.
Well, and I think that you also have to kind of consider some of the social factors. Maybe I should have said this toward the beginning of the episode, but, you know, I didn't know this. I had to look this up for the episode, but I mean, looking at the social factors and why there were people coming from Jamaica and emigrating from Jamaica around these times. So just to sum up as much as I can, and it's obviously summing up, I'm condensing as much as I can, and I know this is not every Jamaican person. Just like many islands in the Caribbean, they were the island of Jamaica was used for slave labor that had a lot of plantations on it and stuff like that. And so when slavery was outlawed, it took a long time for slavery to totally be ended in the Caribbean. It didn't just happen overnight. Like it was proclaimed slavery is dead, you know, and we're going to stop this. It didn't quite happen that way. That being said, it took a generation or two in Jamaica and in some other Caribbean islands for independence to come and for the country to start, I guess, developing. And in the 1950s, might have been the early 1960s, but whatever it was, I can't remember precisely, Jamaica wound up gaining its independence. And in gaining its independence, there immediately after that, because a lot of the infrastructure, I swear I'll get back to the boxing in a moment, everybody, don't yawn, but a lot of the infrastructure had not been set up. A lot of things socially had not been very well set up. And there was a lot of crime immediately following Jamaica's, you know, independence. And so at least in part due to the crime and also due to the fact that there was not a whole lot of work, there weren't very many jobs, a lot of Jamaicans wound up traveling to, for instance, the Windrush generation. As a lot of people know in the UK, they're familiar with that concept. A number of Jamaican immigrants wound up on a boat called the Windrush, arriving in England, and a number of them wound up becoming fighters, or their children wound up becoming fighters. And so a number of people in the UK might be familiar with the Windrush generation and the immigrants from Jamaica. In Trevor Burbick's case, and in the case of, I think it was something like 1 million or 1.5 million other Jamaicans, they found their way to Canada instead. And so in any case, that's where some of this kind of takes root. And I think understanding that a little bit might help to understand Trevor Burbick's situation as somebody who perhaps never really found or felt like he was at home, you know, like, because he wind up as a road warrior, as a fighter, fighting all over the place and never really feeling as though he could fight out of home. So then when he finds himself back at home, it's because he's a criminal. He's already gone through a shitload of trouble, and these two other countries don't want him, and he's forced to go home to Jamaica. And so after he goes back to Jamaica, he settles in a small farming community called Portland. And he was quickly, very quickly, in trouble there too. After arriving home, he was actually, a neighbor accused him of stealing items from their house. And the police were called. Police search Burbick's house, and they find stolen items like a drill, a pickaxe, and a whole bunch of clothes that he had stolen from this neighbor. So already, you know, it's whatever damage was there, it was done, and it was not going anywhere, unfortunately. So it was obviously going nowhere good after this.
By the time he got back to Jamaica, Burbick's life was, it was in a tailspin, man. It was really, really bad. But it seemed by all accounts that he was also, you know, still just getting in with the local scene. He was still worshipped out there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, by people in, you know, local boxing scene, stuff like that. He was known, and as he was in Canada. So people still respected him. He was obviously known as a celebrity, but... And he was, I think, probably involved in the church scene out there too. You know, I know that every time that he walked home, he would walk by the church that he was like frequenting to take that route to get back to his place. But he had stuff going on. You know, in terms of that, there was always trouble following him. And at this point now, he was having disputes with his family, inner family strife. And I don't know all the details, but I think it was something about a land dispute that he was having with his sister. And there was like a lot of like arguments and back and forths and things going on of that matter. And it led to one night where Burbick had a confrontation at a bar that he would frequent with his nephew by the name of Harold. And they said that the last night of Burbick's life, he was at the bar that he would always be at. And he was carrying on, talking with people, having a good time, and just, you know, being on his way. And then he left after a certain time. And I guess at one point his nephew was there and they saw each other, and his nephew claimed that Burbick was like making throat slashing gestures at him and doing other stuff like that. But whatever it was, Burbick was going home and he was walking. And as he was taking the normal route he was taking by the church that he walked by and other stuff like that, he got clunked over the head badly. And it was by a lead pipe. And got hit a few more times to the point where, you know, got his brain damaged, and he was, you know, he was taken out, he was killed him. And it came out that it was his nephew and an accomplice that did it.
He had apparently been doing some sort of training workshops in Trinidad, another island in the Caribbean. And so he was still somewhat active in the boxing community the few years before his death, supposedly. But yeah, so I actually have a photo that perhaps I'll share on social media if anybody's interested, of the church that he was found out in front of. It looks fairly back road-ish. It doesn't look like in the middle of nowhere, but it definitely looks like there's a lot of foliage, and it doesn't look like it's in a big city or anything like that. But the police were called because someone had found his body outside of this church, just this little small, looks like a small house. And the initial reports said that someone had taken an axe to his head and had opened up his head with an axe or a machete, because that's how badly he had been hit with a metal pipe. Because, I mean, I'm not trying to force people to have nasty mental imagery here. And I suppose just fast forward 30 seconds if it disturbs you, but you're hitting somebody with a blunt object so hard that it's opening up like their skull and their head and makes it look as though it's a gaping axe wound. That's either a lot of hits or something big that you're hitting with really hard. So, I mean, I'm not trying to be motherfucking behavior analysis unit Criminal Minds here, but like that kind of sounds like somebody's real mad or extremely scared or something like that, you know, like they're in a panic or they're in a rage or some shit and just beating the hell out of somebody. And it was in the back of his head, suggesting the way that he fell or the way that he was laying, supposedly suggesting as if like he was walking away and that somebody got him from behind. Anyway, there's absolutely no way to know for sure, but many of the things that were reported as far as what led to it and the night out and whatnot and the land dispute were reported from witnesses and rumors who had heard that he was having a land dispute with his nephew. And this other, so anyway, he winds up dead and they're trying to figure out what exactly happened. And the initial reports, as they're reporting this land dispute, the police follow the leads and wind up finding his nephew, a guy named Harold Burbick, and then his friend Kenton Gordon, who was apparently an accomplice in this murder. And they wind up both being hauled into court and found guilty. And Harold is sentenced to life in prison. Kenton is sentenced to like 15 years or something like that. And it actually went very under the radar in the U.S., all things considered. But it was definitely
mentioned in the box and, you know, on the website.
It did.
Stuff, but like just, yeah.
That was considering who he was and his stature and considering what happened. I mean, it didn't really make that much of the
rounds. No, I don't remember like any big articles or anything dedicated to Burbick besides just, you know, he was found killed and what happened to him.
Right.
Dude, I mean, I don't want to sound gory, but I do remember a long time ago, and I'm not going to try to seek him out again because I remember being disturbed even seeing it, but I think I found there was photos of Burbick after the fact. That I actually saw one. But I mean, like, and the only reason why I remember it is because I think he had bleached his hair to blonde at that point. But again, it's not something that I'm not trying to seek it out again, ever again. I don't even know how I came across it. Maybe when I was like searching for info for his murder back then, that somehow I came across a photo or whatever. But like,
man, we've all seen stuff on the internet. We're like not trying to see.
Exactly.
Like just, so,
yeah,
it's. I'm not surprised that something, I mean, dude, there's like death photos of all sorts of like celebrities and stuff like that. It's pretty morbid stuff. We're already doing like a morbid show with this true crime stuff. But look, Trevor Burbick led a life that was absolutely full of strife, that was full of just weird tales. And the guy could just never really seem to settle into a groove with either of his career for a long time or his personal life. Why that is, I don't know. But there obviously seems to be a common thread with a number of these fighters that they just fall apart mentally.
But I will say this for him, man, for all of his crazy inconsistencies and everything else like that, he proved to be one of the more consistent, reliable fighters, at least from the 80s, and I mean, like from the heavyweight scene, that like was still able to translate into the 90s, and that like somehow through it all, he, you know, was able to win the WBC title at one point, and he's, regardless of everything, he's going to be a footnote in history for being the last man to beat to fight Muhammad Ali, and what happened with Mike Tyson, you know, being the man that Mike Tyson won the title from. So
he definitely made his mark on history. And honestly, all things considered, you know, he's obviously the most famous or biggest name fighter that we've spoken about in this kind of series or true crime thing before. You know, he was a big named world, well, a fairly big named world champion who fought Muhammad Ali. That's pretty big deal. So,
and you know, he thinks, and when you think about how zany he was, how crazy his career, everything, you know, regarding it, he fits in absolutely perfectly with what was the lost generation of 80s heavyweights and just that entire era of just ridiculousness that was run by Don King.
Like, crosses paths with Larry Holmes, Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson. I mean, that's that right there is a significant chunk of either the greatest or what people believe are the greatest heavyweights.
Absolutely.
That's pretty serious stuff.
You know, and just an eccentric figure, a fascinating figure, crazy, tragic. There's so many different ways you can describe Burbick, and all of them will probably be apt. So,
yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, in any case, it's a long, winding tale full of crime and full of violence and some icky stuff. But that was Trevor Burbick, and this was another true crime episode, dude. I appreciate you.
That was a lot of fun.
I appreciate you doing another one of these with me and braving the grim, gruesome.
This is my wheelhouse, bro. What you mean? I thought I was probably gonna put on Discovery ID and watch more morbid shit.
I mean, I think that a lot of it is obviously we're entertained by it, but on some level we do want to remember these fighters as well, and we want to make sure that their tales are, I guess, told on a couple different media.
Like we said, man, Burbick is the most high-profile case that there is, but there's still a lot of guys out there that you and I have already discussed, and just in general before even this side piece show that we do now came to fruition. And it's just kind of like their stories deserve to be told too, because at the end of the day, they left a footnote in boxing in their own way, and you know, they're fascinating.
Well, you say you mentioned side piece, so I just gotta say, don't be talking about my side piece. Don't be talking about my side piece. You don't get laid.
Yeah.
That's probably gonna get.
I was ringside for that fight, by the way.
Yeah. Oh my god, dude! I cannot believe Paulie was trying to say he won that. Fans were trying to say he won that. Oh goodness, we're not gonna get into.
I was there. He did.
We're not gonna get into it. It's okay. No. No, it was a lot of fun, dude. I appreciate you doing these. People, I think they probably do understand on some level if they are listening in and are enjoying it. But this takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of research. We're spending a lot of time doing stuff, and that's not to say feel bad for us or praise us. It's just saying, you know, I'm trying to relate that we care about this enough that we're spending a lot of time on it. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that means that if you are on social media and things of that nature, you're going to go ahead and follow, like, my guy, Aris Pina, Punch Zone Aris on Twitter. Follow me, Patrick Connor, Patrick M. Connor. I don't even know if I should be name dropping Facebook or Instagram or anything at this point. Who knows how stable.
I think we back.
Yeah, I think we might be, but we're on those platforms as well. It might be safe, might not be. Also, before I forget and before you forget, before you log off, go ahead and go to manscaped.com and enter the code GLOVE, GLOVE, for 20% off your order and free shipping. But also, of course, the podcast side of it. If you follow the podcast, subscribe on whatever podcast app you do listen into, that would be appreciated. Aris, we will definitely talk soon, my friend.
Absolutely, man. Have a good one.
All right.